Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Monsters by C. Gockel, narrated by Barry Krynick. Chapter 1. Steve Rogers sits at his desk in the FBI's new office for the Chicago Department of Public Liaisons. The small office is on LaSalle Street in Chicago's downtown, the infamous Loop. It's just a few blocks south of City Hall and a little up the street from the Chicago Board of Trade building. Outside, the downtown traffic is a cacophony of engine rumbles, honks, and screeching tires. It's September, but Chicago is experiencing a sweltering Indian summer. The air conditioning in the ancient building hums away, and it's still too hot in the room. With one hand, Steve holds a phone to his ear. In the other, he holds a photo of a little girl. She's wearing a neat navy blue school uniform. Her large brown eyes are bright. Her hair is pulled back in neat black cornrows, and she's smiling at the camera. Steve's own skin is very dark. The little girl's skin is café au lait, like her mother's. Her name is Claire. She's Steve's daughter, and she's 8 years old today. The phone rings once, twice, and three times. Steve closes his eyes, is about to hang up, but then it's answered.
You missed her. She just stepped out with her grandmother. They're going to pick up some balloons.
The woman's voice on the other line sounds tired and irritated, as usual. She says it's all the anger and irritation she stored up during the 8 years of their marriage.
Aw, Dana, Steve says to his ex-wife. Can you go get them? I just want to wish her a happy birthday.
They're gone, Steve, Dana says. Why don't you call her after the party, before we go out to dinner with my folks around 3? Turning to his computer, Steve pulls up his calendar.
I have a meeting at 3 today.
Busy saving the world, says Dana in a bored voice.
It's with the mayor, Steve says.
Old habits kick in and he goes on the defensive.
I'm actually meeting with the heads of the agencies the city set up after 9/11 to deal with terrorism. I think we'll finally start coordinating.
The FBI's main Chicago office is out west a few miles. The whole reason they opened this satellite branch was so that the Bureau could start leveraging local assets, and to do that, they needed agents greasing City Hall's wheels. Steve's only been here a few months, but he's managed to charm the mayor and is on a first-name basis with most of the aldermen. Pride creeps into his voice. He should know better.
Glad the marriage to your job is still going well. 3 o'clock, and that's it, says Dana.
Look, I have to go. There's a delivery. The line goes dead. Setting the phone down, Steve leans back in his chair and puts a hand through his short, cropped hair. He looks at his computer. It's 10 o'clock. He swivels in his chair. Maybe he should get a coffee? An enormous shadow alights in Steve's window, and he jumps up, hand going to the gun at his hip.
What the?
Steve swallows. The biggest raven he's ever seen is on the window ledge. Oblivious to Steve, the raven looks down. With a loud, "rock, rock," it plunges. Steve blinks. He served in Kandahar during his stint in Afghanistan as a United States Marine, but something about that big black bird still makes his heart race. He definitely needs a coffee. Getting up from his desk, he swings on his suit coat to hide his piece. On the way out of his office, he nods at the receptionist and at the other agent in the office, Tanya Fitzpatrick. Older than Steve's 38 by about 15 years, Tanya is half Irish and half Italian, and that goes a long way in this town. She isn't a natural actor like Steve, though, and that doesn't go over quite as well. When you're dealing with politicians, you have to have a high tolerance for bullshit. Steve can tolerate and smile. Right now, Tanya's got her phone pressed to her shoulder, and she's scowling, a long lock of curly gray hair falling over her face. Catching his gaze, she rolls her eyes toward the phone and then holds up a hand for Steve to wait a minute. As Steve watches, she manages to get off the phone with whomever she's talking to and jogs over to him.
Talk to your little girl, she says.
Steve's stomach sinks and he frowns. When it comes to his divorce and Claire, his acting abilities disappear. Raising an eyebrow, Tanya says,
"Let's get some coffee."
She opens her mouth, probably to say something encouraging, but Steve doesn't want to think about his phone call. To change the subject, he smiles and says,
You know, you really shouldn't scowl when you talk on the phone. People can hear it in your voice.
Tanya narrows her eyes up at him. She's only 5'4 or so, and Steve towers over her at nearly 6'5. She maintains her glare and her silence until they reach the ornate but slightly decrepit lobby they share with a bank, a photo shop, and a clothing store. Steve maintains his smile and laughs when her lips quirk up. They actually get along pretty well together. Steve plays good cop, she plays bad cop. It disorients people when the large black man is seemingly less formidable than the small Irish-Italian mom-grandmother type. Together they step out of the building. They take their first breaths of the Chicago heat. Tanya scowls. Steve does, too. Steve spent his early childhood in rural Alabama. Chicago heat is worse than Alabama heat. It's just as humid, maybe more. The sound of traffic is grating, and Steve's sure he can taste the pollution on his tongue. They're just about to cross over Jackson to the wide-open plaza in front of the Chicago Board of Trade when a loud rock, rock sounds above the din of traffic. Next to him, Tanya says, "Those are the two biggest crows I've ever seen." Steve scowls at the sky. Ravens aren't city birds, and these two are enormous, their feathers so black they're nearly blue.
"Those aren't crows, they're ravens," he says.
"How do you know?" Tanya asks.
Before he can answer, both of their phones go off. Meeting each other's gaze, they pick up.
"Agent Rogers,"
he says, as Tanya says her name nearly in unison. The voice on the other end is eerily calm.
"We have a stray kitten reported in the tunnels beneath the Chicago Board of Trade. Containment teams are on their way. Civilian personnel laying fiber optic lines in the LaSalle Tunnel just north of Jackson need to be evacuated. All available agents are requested to assist."
Stray kitten is code for suitcase nuke, and it is currently right under the building just a few yards in front of Steve and Tanya. Their eyes meet, and Steve doesn't have to ask if she received the same call.
"Better to take the entrance to the tunnels in the basement of our building," says Tanya,
and Steve can hear her forcing herself to stay calm. Turning back the way they came, Steve nods.
"Do you think that the local law enforcement has caught wind of this?"
From a few blocks up LaSalle Street comes the screech of police sirens.
"I think so," says Tanya. "I'll go talk to the fellas repairing the fiber optic line," says Steve.
He smiles broadly. Anyone passing by will think they're having a normal conversation. Tilting his head toward the cop cars ensnared a few blocks up in the Chicago traffic, he says,
"You handle them."
Tanya nods and Steve darts back into their building. He's at the far end of the lobby when he hears a woman scream behind him and a loud, "Rock, rock!" Turning, he sees the ravens swoop past a cowering woman at the door and then rise to circle the lobby. Steve's mouth falls open, but he doesn't have time to deal with it. He heads to the staircase that will lead him to the tunnels. Entering the stairway, he takes the steps down two at a time. When he reaches the basement level, there are two doors. One goes to the basement proper, and another leads even further below, to Chicago's underground tunnel system. The tunnel system is behind several security doors, but Steve has keys and authorization for emergencies just like this. He's putting his key into the lock of the first door when he hears a door open and shut above. He freezes.
"Tanya?"
he calls. For a moment, he swears he hears the flap of wings, the clack of claws on metal, and then there is nothing else but the sound of his own breathing. Shaking his head, he turns the key and carefully opens the door. A blast of cold air hits him, and the door swings wide, banging against the wall. Steve has a strange sensation, like someone just pushed past him. He looks back. No one. He looks in front of him. He's alone. There is just a dark, narrow alcove with ancient concrete walls and a fire door with a deadbolt. Beside the fire door is a touchpad for scanning fingerprints and a keypad for entering his personal access code. Taking a breath, Steve goes forward and forces himself to stay calm. But the hairs on the back of his neck rise and he finds himself shivering. He tells himself it's the sudden change of temperature. Down here by the tunnels, it's only about 55 degrees. He swallows. Still, the pressure in the room doesn't feel right. He feels as though someone is in here with him. With another deep breath, he touches his thumb to the fingerprint scanner. A green light goes on and he enters his code. There is a sound of two bolts unlocking, and then all that's left is one more key-activated deadbolt. He has the key in the lock and is almost about to turn it when there is a loud click beneath his fingers, and this door swings wide too. There is another strong gust of cold air. He feels pressure on his chest and finds himself pressed against the door as though by an invisible hand. Something sweeps by him into the darkness, and just as quickly as it came, the pressure on his chest is gone. Steve doesn't panic as a general rule, and he's not panicked now. Could there be something in the air making him hallucinate? He picks up his cell, says, "Tanya," and gets the no-service message. He should have expected that, even if he wasn't at basement level. There is a nuke threat. The FBI is going to block all cell phone signals in a wide radius to keep the nuke from being triggered remotely. Steve looks ahead. There is a poorly lit stairwell with dark, crumbling brick walls and stairs that are just bare metal mesh. The stairs lead down to the tunnel level. Steve goes forward and down, the metal mesh ringing under his feet. The tunnels were built in Chicago in 1903. They were originally designed for laying telephone lines, but by 1914 were being used to haul coal and freight to downtown office buildings along miles of crisscrossing underground rail tracks. By the mid-1950s, they were no longer being used for freight anymore and were mostly derelict until the Silicon era when firms started using some of the tunnels for communication lines. The wire mesh stairway gives way to a concrete platform once used for receiving coal. This area actually belongs to the building he works in and is lit by emergency lighting. There's a low drop of about 2 feet to the tunnel proper and nearly complete darkness. Steve doesn't notice any fiber optic junction boxes, or more importantly, any technicians. He is about to hop down when he notices a long feather, so black it's almost blue, on the floor. Picking it up, he looks around nervously. Slipping it in his pocket, he pulls out his keychain with attached maglite. He is about to turn it on when he glances south, where the LaSalle Tunnel intersects with the Jackson Street Tunnel. Where he stands, the tunnel is only about 7.5 feet high by 6 feet wide, but beneath the Board of Trade is a station, a wide open space where many freight cars could park and men could gather to receive coal and load used ash. That is where a containment perimeter should be established. He sees light there and what looks like the shapes of men in hazmat suits, but they move so little they seem frozen in place. Steve looks quickly up the tunnel to the north. He sees no sign of fiber optic technicians. He should look for them, but... He puts his maglite away, pulls his gun from his holster, and goes as quickly and silently as he can southward toward the light. Walking along the wall, he carefully avoids stepping on the metal tracks in the middle of the tunnel. The sound of his feet don't betray him, but as he gets closer to the station below the Board of Trade, he thinks the loud beating of his heart might. There are men in hazmat suits on the station platform, and a bomb robot, too. They are all as still and silent as statues. In the middle of the Board of Trade platform is what looks like an exploded duffel bag and an exposed metal casing of some kind. In the casing is a sphere, about 2 hands wide, alternately pulsing with light and darkness. Pacing around the pulsating sphere is a Caucasian male, about 50 years old, with a gray beard and an eye patch. He's dressed in armor that looks like Renaissance fair meets SWAT. Circling around him are the two ravens. Oh, shit. Steve finds himself frozen too, not sure if he's hallucinating. From just a few feet behind him, he hears the sound of footfalls. Cursing himself for not paying attention, he turns, gun upraised. And then he lets his arm fall. Two men are in the tunnel he just came down, one older, one younger. The old guy is holding up his bureau badge, but Steve doesn't need to see it to know they're on the same team. The old guy oozes FBI, and he's probably ex-military, too. He's got the classic high and tight haircut and a black suit on. The younger man has a mop of unruly brown hair, a rumpled suit, and he looks like he just rolled out of bed. He's carrying a large cylindrical case over his shoulder and something that looks almost like a Geiger counter. "Agent Rogers," says the old guy. "I'm Assistant Director James Merrill, and this is Agent Erickson." He tilts his head at the young guy. The young guy nods and swallows. Putting his badge away, Merrill says,
We're from the FBI Department of Anomalous Devices of Unknown Origin, also known as ADUO.
What?
Says Steve. He's never heard of ADUO before in his life.
From the platform comes the raucous rawk of the ravens, the beat of wings, and Steve spins again, gun at the ready, to find the ravens flapping just a few meters in front of him. He looks past the birds, the motionless men in their hazmat suits, and the silent robot. The old guy by the sphere is paying Steve and his companions absolutely no attention. One of the ravens looks at Steve, follows his gaze to the old man, and then, turning back to Steve, starts to shriek.
What? What? You thought that Odin needed the staff Gungnir to stop time, human? Well, you are wrong, 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 wrong. Gungnir only concentrates and strengthens his powers. He doesn't need it. It's like Hrnir's hut, or Loki's... Munin, shut up,
squawks the other raven, landing on the ground. Beside him, Steve hears Erikson whisper.
Yep, this is definitely our department.
The raven on the ground rises into the air.
You think you can contain Odin, All-Father, Agent Miles Erikson?
It cackles maniacally. Beside him, Steve hears Erikson swallow.
You tell him, Hugin, cackles the other raven. The world seed will be his. His!
Steve looks past the ravens to the old man they call Odin, still hovering around the sphere. As Steve watches, Odin bends down and tries to lift the sphere. There is a bright flash of light, and then the space around the sphere goes absolutely pitch black, and the man disappears. Steve's ears pop, and he feels air rush from behind him. The two birds flap their wings, squawk, and struggle not to be sucked backwards. Beside him, he hears Erikson shout, "My readings are through the roof!" There is another bright flash of light, and Odin is standing there in front of the sphere again, but only for an instant. The sphere pulses, there is an electric-sounding crackle, and then Odin is flying backwards through the air. With a loud thud, he hits the far wall. The ravens shriek. The sphere hovers in the air about a foot off the ground. The robot inches forward, and the guys in the hazmat suits begin to move.
Go check on Odin, Agent Rogers, says Merrill. Erikson, you're with me.
Gun still out, Steve walks over to the old man in armor, now lying on the floor. The ravens dart around him, gibbering and rawking. It's not English, but sounds eerily human. Behind him, he hears the robot whirring. He picks up snatches of conversation from the guys in hazmat suits. No radiation readings or biohazard signs. How did those guys get in here? What happened? Steve prods the old man with a shoe. Odin, if that is his name, doesn't move. His eyelids don't even flutter, but his armor swirls with light. From behind him, he hears someone say,
"What are those guys doing?"
Steve turns to see Erikson and Merrill erect a strange silvery wire fence woven in hexagonal patterns around the sphere. As they close the seam of the fence, it seems to melt and coalesce over and under the sphere, forming a sphere of its own about 4 feet in diameter. The glowing sphere thing hovers in midair at the center.
"What the hell?"
says a guy in a hazmat suit. Taking out his badge and holding it up, Merrill says,
"Department of ADUO."
"I thought those guys were a joke,"
someone else says. Next to Merrill, Miles bends over his Geiger counter thing, seemingly oblivious to everything. Shaking his head, he says,
"Readings are still off the charts."
Within the new mesh sphere, the first small sphere begins to pulse again with light and dark. Suddenly, prongs of a dark material shoot outward from the glowing sphere like spokes and twist around the hexagonal netting.
"What the hell?"
says someone. And then the outer shell begins to grow, the hexagonal pattern stretching and throbbing, black material from the glowing sphere's spokes crawling and curling around the mesh. Miles and Merrill turn.
"It's never done that before,"
Miles shouts as Merrill pulls him back. From beside Steve, a deep male voice roars.
"What have you done?"
And then everything stops again. All the guys in hazmat suits are immobilized, as are Merrill and Erikson. The only things moving are the mesh sphere, pulsing outward, the silvery wire transforming to thick bars of black and silver, and for some reason, Steve and the robot rolling towards the sphere. The robot is just a small 3x3-foot black metal body on tread wheels with one long groping steel arm. As the arm hits the outer sphere, now composed of dark bars, sparks fly around the machine. There is blackness within the outer sphere. There is the rush of air again. This time it is so brusque some of the immobilized people by the sphere actually fall over, including Erickson and Merrill. Steve's ears pop again, and then the robot just isn't there. The darkness fades, and through the bars he sees the pulsing blue light of the sphere.
"You will tell me where you got the technology for the outer sphere!"
Steve turns. The old man with one eye, Odin, is standing beside him, his armor pulsing with the same blue light as the sphere. Steve hears the raven's wings and, far off, a subway. Before he can process what is happening, Odin's hand shoots to Steve's neck. Steve tries to move, but he can't. Below his neck, his whole body feels numb. He doesn't have the foggiest idea where the technology came from, or even really what the Department of Aduo is, but no way in hell will he tell this guy. Odin blinks. His one eye widens, and then he smiles, and it does not make Steve happy. Still, with a smile of his own, Steve says,
"Agent Steve Rogers, identification number..."
"You don't know, but perhaps the Department of Aduo does,"
the man hisses.
"I hear you in my head, Agent Rogers."
Steve's mouth drops open. One of the ravens lands on the man's armor and whispers something in his ear. Leaning forward, Odin whispers,
"Steve Rogers, people I hear tend to be destined for greatness, the gallows, or both."
He pulls back.
"Things will want the world seed. Very bad things. Very bad people. You must keep it safe."
The other raven lands on Odin's opposite side and says, "Claire! Claire!" Steve's eyes go wide. He spits and hits the damn bird squarely between the eyes. With a squawk, it rises into the air. Odin's smile becomes almost grandfatherly.
"Keep her safe, Stephen."
The hand releases. Steve blinks, and Odin and the birds are gone. From behind him, he hears movement. He turns, and over the heads of Merrill, Erickson, and some of the guys in hazmat suits, he sees the sphere. The outer shell is nearly 8 feet by 8 feet now. Someone says,
"What the hell happened?"
Erickson, looking at his Geiger counter, or whatever it is, says,
"It's still growing, but it seems to have stabilized. Magic levels have dropped."
"Where's the bomb bot?" someone says.
"Shit,"
says someone else. That would be Steve's assessment, too. A cell phone goes off. Dusting himself off and standing up, Merrill pulls his phone out of his jacket, mumbling about a secure channel. And then he turns to his partner Erickson and says,
"Just got a report of an 8-legged horse on the corner of Jackson and LaSalle."
He takes a breath, phone still at his ear.
"And now it's gone."
Saying something under his breath that sounds suspiciously like a curse, Merrill looks around the room.
"Did anyone see what happened when we were immobilized?"
"Immobilized?"
says someone else. Stepping forward, Steve lifts a hand. With a nod, Merrill says,
"Agent Rogers, you're coming with us."
Amy Lewis stands across the desk from Agent Steve Rogers in the new downtown office of the Department of Aduo. The department used to be located in the main FBI office way out on West Roosevelt in kind of a sketchy neighborhood. But a few days ago, they suddenly moved to a new office right across from the Board of Trade. She plays receptionist for Aduo. Plays is the operative word. All the calls that come in seem to be classified and bypass her completely. It gives her lots of time to read, though, and that gives her a chance to keep up with her studies and apply for financial aid for next year and reapply for her scholarship. Also, the pay is good, the hours regular. Steve is standing between piles of files in cardboard boxes, looking out the window, a huge black shadow in silhouette.
"You called me in, sir?"
she says, wringing her hands. Steve hates her. She's not exactly sure why.
"Why were you 1.5 hours late today?"
Steve says, turning around. His face is flat and unreadable.
Well, I was coming in at my usual time, and as I was walking down the alley, a pigeon with a broken wing came running toward me, because obviously it couldn't fly, and, well, I tried to ignore it, because, you know, there are feral cats in the neighborhood, and they deserve to eat, too, but it climbed up onto my shoe. I think it imprinted on me. And, you know, once something thinks you're its mother, you can't abandon it.
Agent Rogers' mouth opens slightly. Amy looks at the desk. Which doesn't exactly explain why I'm late.
I'm late because I took it to the clinic. I left a message on Assistant Director Merrill's voicemail.
Assistant Director Merrill has been reassigned, says Rogers. I'm acting Assistant Director for now.
Amy bites her lip. Oh, shit.
Miss Lewis, says Steve. I haven't gotten to your file yet.
He waves a hand at the desk, and Amy sees a stack of old-fashioned manila and red folders.
But I have to wonder, what are you doing here?
Amy's mouth opens, but she's uncertain what he means, and no sound comes out.
I mean, what are you doing at this job? Says Steve.
Oh, well then. I'm here because Agent Merrill offered me a job after he interviewed me, she says.
Right after she found out Loki stole all her money and her grandmother broke her hip and then had a stroke, Agent Merrill had shown up at the hospital. He interviewed her extensively about Loki's time with her and confiscated her and Beatrice's Alfheim clothes and their Subaru. All Amy's got left of the trip is a hadrosaur feather and a few glowing hairpins Beatrice misplaced in the garage by her gardening tools.
Uh-huh, says Steve. I never see you actually answering the phone, Amy, or doing any typing or filing.
Amy blinks.
Well, no one ever really gives me anything to...
Do you realize how deep in debt our country is?
Steve says, sitting down and scowling up at her. That's got to be a trick question. Amy tilts her head.
Doesn't it change minute to minute with compounded interest?
Steve is quiet for a moment, and then he gives her a hard glare and says,
I love my country, and I hate to see anyone taking advantage of it, even in small ways.
Yes, sir, says Amy.
There is no I in the word team, Amy, and no dead weight either. Find work to do or find another job.
Amy swallows. She can find a new job, but one that pays as well and one she won't have to relocate for or force her to buy a car? Not in the months before she goes back to school. She's promised the university 1 year off and nothing more. She's found a great place to live. The upstairs is owned by a fellow vet tech and her doctor fiancé. And Amy gets to work at the vet clinic on nights and weekends and keep her skills up. She actually got to take part in a surgery last weekend. She can't lose this job.
Sir? She says.
Yes, Miss Lewis,
says Steve, looking down at a manila folder with a bright red post-it attached on his desk.
Do you have anything you'd like me to do?
She asks. Steve looks up at her like he wishes she would spontaneously combust. And then he spins in his chair, gets up, grabs a large box of files marked Purchase Orders, Non-Classified, and nearly throws it at her.
Take this and organize them in reverse chronological order. Make sure anything on the same date is alphabetized, too.
Stumbling back a little bit under the weight of the box, Amy says,
Okay, yes, sir,
and leaves the office with Steve already bent over one of the folders. Amy takes the box back to her desk and tries not to cry. Why did Agent Merrill have to leave? It turned out a duo had been watching her house ever since she met Loki. Merrill was the same old guy with two square jaw she'd seen buying ice cream one day. And the Mexican ice cream guy? A duo, too, Agent Hernandez. She likes Agent Merrill. He is steadying, calm, and kind. Now she is stuck with some patriotic hard-ass. Opening the box, she rifles through a few folders. This assignment makes her want to cry even more than Rogers yelling at her. The files already look like they are in order, which means she's just verifying they are in order, which is worse than ordering them to begin with. There is a special room in hell for file organization quality control. Swallowing back her tears, she rifles through the files. She blinks. There is a red folder wedged beneath the purchase orders. Red almost always means classified. She should pick it up and take it to Rogers right now. She digs out the folder and is going to take it to the office, really, when she notices the words Agent Steve Rogers on the tab. Hum. She shouldn't.
She really shouldn't. She looks at the red folder in her hands. She looks back at the box of filing.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?